This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. One reason only a quarter of furloughed Black Jewel employees have found new jobs is because existing job openings pay less.
I want that 401k, I want that pension, I want whatever comes with it. I feel like my family deserves that.
Northwest College is introducing new programs like a conservation law enforcement degree to help with its declining enrollment.
This went from being incredibly difficult to get hired to now we're looking for folks.
One of the most advanced forensic laboratories is located in Laramie. It solves wildlife-related attacks and crime.
We have a lot of evidence that we keep here, so we have a lot of refrigerator space.
We'll have those stories and much more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. It's been 2 months since coal company Black Jewel filed for bankruptcy. The move put more than 1,500 miners out of a job in Wyoming and across Appalachia. Many are still struggling to find work. It turns out that struggle isn't just about the job market. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
Quick! Quit!
Darlene Ray calms down her three dogs outside Gillette. Until 2 months ago, Ray worked in Black Jewel's warehouse, writing invoices, receiving freight. But since the coal company's abrupt bankruptcy, she's been stuck looking for work.
Every day, you keep waiting and wondering if somebody's going to call you, you know, and there's nothing.
Ray slaps down a sheet of paper listing all the places she's applied for jobs.
Peabody Energy, Cloud Peak, Campbell County Hospital, Walmart, Pegasus.
Next to many is the word rejection. Ray has a medically retired husband and a mortgage. Worst comes to worst, she'll have to sell the house and move. A tough option with grandkids nearby. She's struggling despite what she's hearing, that the job market in Gillette is strong. The local workforce center says companies are underemployed, unlike the downturn in 2015 and 2016. Even Black Jewel had openings until its bankruptcy July 1st. That day, when the company went under, it furloughed about 600 employees. 2 months later, only a quarter of those workers are back to work, plus a small skeleton crew, according to local management. With a strong job market, Ray has an idea why people like herself are struggling to find work. It's about job skills.
If you know how to drive a haul truck, can run a shovel, you know, an electrician, a mechanic, a welder, yeah, the mines are picking you up left and right.
Rick Mansheim with the Gillette Workforce Center agrees. Mines are looking for skilled positions. But he says that's not the only reason so many locals aren't back to work. Most of those reasons don't have to do with the job market itself.
I think most of them are just waiting to see what happens.
In other words, hoping to get their old job back. At the start of Black Jewel's bankruptcy, warehouse worker Melissa Peterson Warden fell into that category. We're talking in her office, as she calls it, a restaurant in downtown Gillette.
The one thing I've always heard is a mine will never close. They will never close a mine. And in one day, they close two.
But still, she was sure Eagle Butte and Bel Air would reopen and wanted to wait.
I wanted to be a part of that group that brought the mines back and came up from this unheard of thing that we had just gone through.
Being a part of that group meant she would get her old job back and restore these historic mines. Her plan, her hope, affected her job search.
I didn't even make it into the door of the job fair because my heart wasn't in it.
But now, after over 2 months of the mines staying closed, Peterson Warden's attitude has shifted. In fact, she would no longer work at Black Jewel, especially after hearing the potential buyers Contura do not plan to keep the mines open long term. But she still wants to get back in her field. That's where her focus is.
For me to accept a job that's either not in my field or not at the pay rate I want, that would be a temporary job to me. You know, I still want to be in my field. I still want to be associated with coal mining. There's definitely a standard of living that I would like to maintain.
Gillette Workforce Center's Mansheim says that's another common reason many are still out of work. The urge to continue that specific lifestyle of a miner, with good pay and long hours. However, Mansheim says those jobs are harder to come by. So, former Black Jewel workers have moved elsewhere. South Carolina, Utah, Nevada, Arizona. all to find better, higher-paying jobs.
Hey, how's it going, man?
Hey, man.
Dan Zarecki is moving to Montana for that reason.
I have had the option, several options, to take a big pay cut and work here in town. I want that 401k. I want that pension. I want whatever comes with it. I feel like my family deserves that.
Zarecki has a family and a baby due in October. His family wants him to stay in town. He'd prefer it too. But he says it's a dog-eat-dog world. You have to make sacrifices to get what you want.
It's only 2.5 hours away. I'll be able to come here on my days off. And it's worth it.
Workforce Center's Manchheim says the job-seeking traffic has slowed down since the bankruptcy. But a new wave is coming in. People who've waited for Black Jewel to reopen are now ready to move on. He says a furloughed worker came in today and was ready to finally start a job search. It's been over 2 months now, and technically, Black Jewel has still not laid anyone off. But in Gillette, it sure feels that way. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Nationally, community college enrollments have been declining in the past couple of years. Wyoming is no exception. In Powell, Northwest College enrollment is among the lowest in the state. So, the college is looking at some new degree programs to try and turn things around. Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudalska reports that includes a conservation law enforcement degree.
All right, let's get started, folks. So, today I wanted to do an overview of the National Park System.
That's Tony Inerva. He's the professor at the conservation law enforcement degree at Northwest College.
Two national parks. What are they? He asked.
Yellowstone.
Good. There we go. We got somebody half awake. What about the rest of you?
Inerva is originally from Maine, where he helped start a conservation law enforcement degree program there. He says when he applied for his position in Powell, he was surprised Wyoming didn't have a similar program.
There's a need for rangers, park police, BLM, U.S. Forest Service, National Park Service, National Recreation Areas. All of them have a need for law enforcement. They have their own law enforcement jurisdictions.
According to Inerva, there are only 7 community colleges and 6 four-year schools in the country with conservation law enforcement degrees. The closest one is in Greeley, Colorado. So, to him, it was a no-brainer that Wyoming, with 2 national parks and plenty of national forests, could use such a program.
Some of the new programs that we are looking at implementing to be able to meet the workforce needs of the area.
That's Northwest College President Stephanie Hickswah. She says, as a result of the declining enrollment, the college is trying to serve more than just high school graduates in the region.
To give employers the educated workforce that they need, and then to also give students in the area, whether they're graduating high school students or adults who've thought about going back to college, opportunities that they may not have had before.
Hickswah says new trade programs like the 2-year conservation law enforcement degree fits this new approach perfectly. They looked at the Department of Labor statistics and chatted with employers in the area and realized there is a need for law enforcement personnel in national parks, national forest land, and wilderness areas.
My name is Scott Werbelow, and I'm the game warden supervisor in the Cody region.
When Werbelow graduated from college, there was no easy way to get trained to become such a thing as a ranger or a game warden. So he ended up taking a long, winding path that included temporary jobs with Game and Fish until a game warden position opened up.
It went from being incredibly difficult to get hired to now we're looking for folks.
More jobs are opening up as baby boomers are retiring. Werbelow points out that one of the attractive things about the Northwest College program is that people can get qualified to work for an agency like Game and Fish in 2 years.
Having this program in Powell, right in the heart of Wyoming and you know, with all the abundance of wildlife in the Cody area and the interest in hunting and fishing with students coming up, I just think having that opportunity versus having to go to Laramie will gather another pool of possible good candidates.
However, if people are interested in becoming something like a game warden or entering into a management position quickly, their credits may transfer to the University of Wyoming more easily than they have in the past. People can also become a game warden by simply getting the 2-year degree, but that will require a few years of field experience. Tony DeLange hopes to become one of the first students to graduate with a conservation law enforcement degree this May, and he's excited about his future.
I'm looking at the National Park Service and getting in with the Forest Service, although there's only two ranger slots available here in the Cody region.
Northwest College hopes its program will not only meet local needs, but needs throughout the region. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Coming up, we look at a wildlife forensics lab in Laramie and discuss the need for prescribed burns. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. In May, a hiker in Colorado was attacked by a black bear. She lived to tell the tale, but what about the bear? Did wildlife managers track it down and figure out why it was attacking humans? As Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen reports, that's where one very unique forensics lab in our state enters the story.
For a lot of people, when they hear about forensic science, they may think about this. The CSI television franchise is set in places like Miami, New York, and Las Vegas. But in fact, one of the most advanced forensic laboratories in the country is right here in the Mountain West.
We do the wildlife attack cases, and then we do...
That's Kim Frazier, the director of the Wyoming Game and Fish Department's forensic lab. And that buzzing you can sort of hear, that's because Frazier and I are standing in front of three heavy-duty walk-in freezers.
We have a lot of evidence that we keep here, so we have a lot of refrigerator space.
That evidence includes blood and hair samples from all kinds of animals, from pronghorn to mountain lion and bighorn sheep to grizzly bear. Last May, a DNA sample from a black bear showed up from Aspen. It was evidence from a wildlife attack on hiker Janet Jansen.
We'd love to hike. That's the thing we love to do.
Jansen's from Pasco in Washington, but she was in Aspen on summer vacation. She and her husband were hiking Hunter's Creek Trail. It's only about a mile from downtown. Jansen says it was early in the morning on a really beautiful day. They'd been following a stream next to the trail for about 10 minutes.
And then all of a sudden a bear came walking down the trail towards us.
Jansen says they knew not to run. Instead, she says they wanted to give the bear a wide berth, so they slowly started backing up. They backed all the way up to the edge of the stream.
Then he started to pass us, just kept going down the path. And then, you know, when he was right by us, he just kind of randomly pushed me over with his head and bit my leg.
Jansen says at that moment, she yelled at the bear.
No, go away, really loud.
And it did. Jansen says she was bleeding pretty heavily, so she laid down in order to elevate her leg while her husband soaked her fleece jacket in the stream to use as a cold compress. Eventually, she and her husband made it back to the trailhead and took a taxi to the hospital.
They didn't want to give stitches because it was puncture wounds. The two back teeth had pretty deep puncture wounds.
Instead, they rinsed the wound with saline and gave her an antibiotic IV. But before that, DNA from Jansen's wound was collected. Matt Yamashita is with the Colorado Parks and Wildlife. He says these cases are treated just like law enforcement would with any other crime.
The difference here is that, you know, our suspect is going to be something that we, you know, obviously we're not able to go out and interview the suspect.
Along with collecting a DNA sample, Yamashita says they canvassed the area, interviewing other hikers and residents to help identify the right bear to be euthanized. But it was video of the bear taken by a resident earlier that week that was the linchpin.
In going through and analyzing the video, we were able to confirm that it was a bear that matched the same general size description, behavioral patterns, even the location. You know, it was coming back within a couple hundred yards of the location of the attack.
After they got a hold of the bear and tranquilized it, they were able to match its teeth measurements to the bite marks on Janet Jansen's leg. But Yamashita says ultimately it was the DNA match that allowed his agency to confirm it was the same bear.
This particular incident, this was a great example of being able to utilize some of these extensive forensic tools like DNA testing in order to help us get 100% clarity on what was happening.
Yamashita says the agency was also able to identify the contents of the bear's stomach. It was full of birdseed, which points to a growing problem across Colorado and the region. conflicts between bears and humans.
The primary issue is humans providing, whether intentionally or accidentally, providing some sort of an artificial food source.
The increasing number of human-animal conflicts are keeping Kim Frazier at the Wyoming Game and Fish Department's forensics lab busy. So is working on the Mountain West CSI unit as exciting as the TV versions in Miami and Las Vegas?
Yeah, you know, it can be both. It can be exciting when we get new cases in, or if we try to bring new testing online, that's exciting. Sometimes, though, it can be the same thing over and over again every day. So yeah, it's really not as glamorous as it sounds.
For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
A recent study says the American West should be doing more prescribed burns to keep healthy forests healthy and to help lessen the impacts of wildfires across our region. It also concluded that there needs to be a change in how we perceive the practice out here for that to happen. Our Mountain West News Bureau's Noah Glick has more.
Let's go back about 75 years to a famous catchphrase.
Remember, only you can prevent forest fires.
The Smokey the Bear ad campaign began in 1944. It was part of an effort by the U.S. Forest Service to communicate to the public that fires as a whole were bad. At the time, the agency's fire management policy stated that all wildfires needed to be suppressed by 10 o'clock the morning after they're first spotted.
The historical legacy is what really is driving sort of the modern trends.
That's Crystal Colden, an associate professor of fire science at the University of Idaho. Part of that legacy, she says, is the Great Fire of 1910. That blaze burned 3 million acres in northern Idaho and western Montana, with smoke being seen as far away as New York State. And it was this perception of fire that stayed in the American consciousness for much of the 20th century.
You know, it's the death and destruction image of fire.
She says while aggressive fire suppression techniques were underway in the West, the southeastern region of the U.S. was trying something else.
They started using prescribed fire in the southeast, actually not to reduce wildfire risk, but to improve habitat for species that they like to hunt.
Colden says that's helped to change the public sentiment around the practice in that region, where they see fires as an intentional process to control the landscape.
And it's the exact opposite in the West. Most Westerners have never seen a prescribed fire. That's much more likely that they've seen a wildfire.
Colden recently published an article in the journal Fire. In it, she states that other areas of the country are increasing usage of prescribed fires, including a rise across Indian country. But in the West, the practice has been decreasing. And she says that's a problem.
Science has only increased in its findings that prescribed fire is not only a very good way to mitigate wildfire risk, but that it's actually really a necessary component for healthy ecosystems.
That might sound counterintuitive, but think of it this way. Prescribed fires burn grass, brush, and undergrowth, things that help fuel wildfires. These controlled burns also provide the heat needed for things like sequoia and redwood trees to crack open their cones and release seeds. But they also come with risk.
Embers from smoldering brush ignited the Little Valley Fire.
The Little Valley Fire began south of Reno in fall of 2016 following a prescribed burn. High winds in the area carried embers from that blaze, which ignited a wildfire. By the end of it all, it burned nearly 2,300 acres and destroyed 23 homes. The Nevada Division of Forestry was in charge of the controlled fire and was later found guilty of gross negligence. This year, the division reached a $25 million settlement with victims. Casey Casey is the state forester.
Even with the best intentions and the best written plan, things can still go wrong.
Casey says since the Little Valley Fire, the division has rewritten its policies concerning prescribed fires to plan for bigger environmental impacts than they previously had predicted.
It's a different environment now. With climate change, with the current condition of our forests and our rangelands, you can expect a lot more of these extreme environmental wind impacts.
Planning a prescribed burn is pretty complex as is. Casey says land managers look at dozens of variables, from relative humidity to wind conditions to the desired fuel to be burned, and of course, contingency plans in case anything goes wrong.
The planning process usually needs to start almost a year in advance. There's a lot of modeling that needs to go on. There's a lot of thought that needs to go into it. There's a lot of coordination.
And then you've got to have the right conditions. Casey says oftentimes plans sit dormant for years because the weather just isn't right for a burn. It's all very complicated, and as Ryan Elliott says, controlled burns will never be a silver bullet. Elliott is a fire investigator for the Bureau of Land Management, and he does say there is one simple fix. Most fires are started by humans, so...
do whatever you can to not start them. And that sounds like a glib answer, but it's the truth.
So maybe after 75 years, we still have something to learn from Smokey the Bear. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Noah Glick.
When we come back, we will explore the growth of hate speech in the region, and we continue our belonging series with a pair of students from Torrington. This is Open Spaces. This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. Today we begin the third installment of the Belonging series. Around 60% of 18 to 24-year-olds leave the state each year, so Wyoming Public Radio has turned the microphone over to young people to talk about what's behind their decisions to stay or go. Recent Torrington High School graduates Quentin Meyer and Ryan Walson love Wyoming as it is. The childhood friends sat down to reflect on the agriculture and stories that pulled them to stay while acknowledging the career possibilities that may draw their lives outside of the state they hold dear.
I wouldn't change a thing about Wyoming. I love it out as.
Yeah. I love being able to walk outside and you can see for miles and there's hills, and I mean, there's a lot of sagebrush, but every once in a while you come across some nice trees.
Yeah, one of the things I always also admire is the open hay fields, especially during the summer. Yeah. You see the hay come grow up, and then they lay it down, and it's laid down, and you see it dry, and you're like, oh, they got to bale it soon. Then they bale it, and the hay grows back up. I think that's cool watching that rotation, I guess you could say, of growing crops and the farming agriculture of this county.
Yeah. Have you ever been tempted to leave Wyoming?
Yeah, and, you know, I kind of plan on doing that. Well, it's hard to say. You know, engineering, I'm going to start in Casper because one of my main goals in life is to come out of college completely debt-free. And to do that, I did kind of use livestock judging as a way of paying for my college. So I'll be livestock judging and doing engineering at Casper College. And then after that, I'm going to have to find a university to finish that with, whether that's UW, or I also got an offer from Texas A&M. And finding an engineering job in Wyoming is going to be a lot harder than in places like the metropolitan area like Denver. I mean, that'd be a lot easier finding a civil engineering job or a mechanical engineering job because there's so much more infrastructure and so much more building that's going on there. That's really what comes down for me. I would love to live in Wyoming when I'm older. I mean, that's my kind of my goal, is to retire here and have a ranch with some sheep or cattle or something. Have you been tempted to leave?
I have been a little bit because I'm going to school in Milford, Nebraska to become a John Deere tech. And I mean, around here, there are a lot of people that need tractors and stuff worked on, but you can leave and go to a bigger place or a bigger community and stuff, and you can find a job for more money, but it also does come down to where do you want to live? Where are you happy and stuff like that? So it's kind of up in the air, but definitely not moving anytime soon.
Has there ever been a time that you felt like you didn't belong in Wyoming?
I honestly don't think so. I mean, been here my whole life and just everything I do is pretty easy to do in Wyoming.
Yeah.
Going out and shooting raccoons on canal roads. Yep. And spotlighting coyotes and stuff like that.
Yep. You can't do that in a big city. You can't go just driving on the canal road shooting raccoons in the middle of the night.
You shoot a raccoon in town in New York, you're...
yeah, you're getting sent...
you're 5 feet from somebody else.
Yep, yeah. I got to agree with you. I don't know if there's been a time I've ever not felt like I belonged in Wyoming. Honestly, it's a pretty welcoming place, I think.
It is.
And that might be because we're born here and we know everybody, but at the same time, I feel like these are great people that are very welcoming. I can't tell you the amount of times I've gone to a family branding or whatever when we go help someone brand, and that's cool, that sense of community, you know. I feel connected to that, connected to ag, connected to farming. I mean, we're not huge into it, but it's still a part of my blood, part of my family.
Yeah, going and working for Dietzler Farms, going out on the ranch and you're just fixing fence and looking, then all you see is hills and grass for miles.
Yes.
And just peaceful and definitely clears the mind.
Yeah, and you're lonely. It's only you and, like, your thoughts. And there's nobody else around you except for the cattle. And you can talk to them if you want. I mean, I've done that a few times.
They ain't gonna make fun of you.
Yeah, they ain't gonna make fun of you. They're not gonna judge you. It's kind of a sense of you just being here by yourself. We have that freedom. Because who's gonna tell you no in the middle of nowhere?
Yeah. Yeah, Wyoming is definitely type of place that, I mean, you can live a ways away and still have your peace and quiet and feel alone but with somebody, and you can still drive a little ways and still be able to go find the people and do the things you want in town.
I think it's the balance between the two.
Yeah.
When you feel like you need to have some alone time and or you need to be with people, when you're out on the, at the farm and you're by yourself, it makes those moments like with people in town even like sweeter, you know?
Yeah.
You got to love that what kind of way of life.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love just being a country folk. One of my most favorite things is the stories of old men and women too. Yeah. I mean, old ranch women are some of the smartest people I know.
Yeah.
Since we just graduated and we know a lot of our classmates are not going to be sticking around here, why do you think that is?
Yes, Torrington is kind of a ranch and farm community, but there are a lot of kids that are kind of wanting to move on to different things, and they're not, like, they're just not farm and ranch type kids. And just like me, even like you wanting to be a mechanical engineer, there's not really much place you can do that around here.
No, yeah.
So I feel like just for them, they find out what they want to do, kind of can't really stick around here.
Yep.
Yeah, Wyoming is definitely a place more for hunting outfits and ranches.
Yep.
That's Quentin Meyer and Ryan Walson for our series Belonging, where we ask young people to reflect on their place in Wyoming. Charles Fournier produced this piece.
We usually don't think of the Mountain West as a haven for white supremacy, but the Anti-Defamation League recently found that the region is responsible for 10% of all white supremacy propaganda, even though there is just 5% of the population here. The foothold racism and other bigotry have in Wyoming inspired one Laramie man to begin documenting hate-filled comments he's found online in his community. Wyoming Public Radio's Jeff Victor has more.
Scroll through the comments below any political news story, and you're likely to find more than a few vicious or mean-spirited posts. Most people ignore these comments, but not Michael McDaniel. He spends a little time every day digging into the worst of these online opinions. It's his way of fighting the hate, racism, and Nazis in his community.
So like you see here, I'm going to my inbox, and this gentleman sent me a screenshot of an argument on somebody's personal page that he was friends with.
The screenshot captures an exchange between two Wyomingites in a comment section. One of them lets loose with an aggressive comment, making casual use of a racial slur.
So what I do is I look up the person's name and see if their Facebook page is open. If people leave their Facebook pages relatively open, you can get a sense of who they are as a person.
McDaniel scrolls to the commenter's personal profile and learns that the commenter is a recent graduate of Sheridan High School and that he frequently posts negatively about women.
But this is the one that really kind of got me.
Here's the commenter's quote that offends McDaniel. Quote, "You know, it's kind of ridiculous that there be girls that their vaginas have more confirmed kills than my future AR-15. End quote. It's comments like these that led McDaniel to launch his own Facebook page, Wyoming Hate Watch. There, he shares the results of his investigations into the people behind these bigoted or hateful Facebook comments.
I just want the community to be aware that these people are out there. You know, if you are part of a minority population, I'm sure it would be to your benefit to know that there's people out there that are in your community that hate you specifically because your race or religion.
McDaniel has been running Wyoming Hate Watch for just a few weeks now, but it's already attracted more than 400 followers. While the page is new, hate and bigotry in the Equality State are not. In 1885, 28 Chinese coal miners were killed in the Rock Springs Massacre, and in 1998, Matthew Shepard was murdered for his sexual orientation. More recently, the white nationalist group Identity Europa, now called the American Identity Movement, put up flyers at the University of Wyoming and around the state. Then in 2018, the Laramie Police Department arrested someone who spray-painted Jesus Sucks on the walls of a Catholic church. The young man was charged with 4 counts of property destruction and 1 count of littering. Laramie Police Chief Dale Stalder says bias-motivated crimes are reported to the state and the FBI, but are treated no differently in the state's courts.
Whatever that criminal behavior is, there is no enhancements if it's bias-motivated. In some states, you have that bias enhancement, but not in Wyoming.
Vandalism is just vandalism, even if it's in a church. And homicide is just homicide, even if it's motivated by bigotry. And last year, someone replaced the American flag in Laramie's Washington Park with the flag of Nazi Germany. The stars and stripes were folded and left nearby, so there was no charge of theft. And the raising of the Nazi flag was not, in itself, illegal. Nor was the burning of a Koran during a rally in Gillette in 2016. Lieutenant Chuck Deaton was monitoring the scene that day with other officers from the Gillette Police Department.
It was actually a very boring day. What I remember the most from it is me standing out in the sun, getting my bald head sunburned.
Counter-protesters organized before the rally and showed up to voice their disapproval. Deaton says most incidents like this happen without event, but says law enforcement has to plan for every possible outcome.
Our job here is to keep the community safe, and so you have to stay on top of things like that. Certainly when we get information about threats, things like that, we certainly investigate them as far as we can, and of course take extra steps as well to ensure the safety of the public.
I think it's just really challenging for law enforcement because until laws are broken, there's not a whole lot that they can do.
That's Tanya Crumright. She's a member of the group Gillette Against Hate and helped to organize the counter-protest at the Koran burning rally.
You know, I personally think there are limits to free speech and we should be able to recognize those limits, but it's such a gray area that law enforcement really has their hands tied, I think.
Crumright says that's why it's important to show up and counter hate speech.
I really believe that the most important thing is it's really hard to hate up close. And so if we can really get people communicating and talking, it can't do anything but help.
McDaniel's posts on Wyoming Hate Watch often highlight examples of hate speech, racism, and prejudice that others would brush off. But he says the page is even more important in the wake of racially motivated shootings in El Paso and other places.
There's still a lot of people out there who, you know, are not on one side or the other, and they think that this is not going to happen here or that we don't have these types of people in our community. You got to be aware when these people are making these statements, you know, because it could happen anywhere.
McDaniel says it would be nice if his page could change some people's minds, but he isn't holding out hope. For now, he'll just keep posting. For Wyoming Public Radio, this is Jeff Victor.
Changing gears, the Wyoming Department of Transportation is currently working on its master plan that would cover the department's vision for the next 5 years. But in the meantime, WyDOT has released its list of the projects it wants to tackle in 2020. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler spoke with WyDOT Director Luke Reiner about how the State Transportation Improvement Plan shows how the department is still struggling with a lack of funding.
Currently, the Department of Transportation is short in terms of funding, and it's short, what we reported to the legislature, is about $135 million short of maintaining assets in the current condition. So we went several years ago, based on really our shortfalls in funding, to what we'll call a focus on asset preservation, and really the theory there is that it's really important for us to try to care for the assets that we have. And so when you look at the bid letting and the bid letting schedule that was released, really what jumps in my mind to the forefront is the fact that most, almost all, of the projects that you see in there are projects that maintain our roads and work to keep them in good repair. What you don't see is improvements to roads in terms of capacity or mobility. And that's just because we don't have the money. And we've chosen to focus on preserving what we do have. Now, there are a few projects that fit into the capacity level, and those are really predominantly on there because of safety issues. For example, there are some lights that are going into Riverton. The other one that might jump out to you is there's a five-lane widening of Highway 59 in the area of Wright. And again, that's a safety issue with lots of mine traffic coming through there.
You know, funding for WyDOT keeps coming up in talks with the legislature. Have you all been talking with legislators about ways the department can get more long-term funding?
The Joint Revenue Committee actually came up with the idea and passed out of committee an increase of 3 cents to our state fuel tax. And so that would help in terms of making a dent in the unfunded list. So the 3 cent increase in the fuel tax, that is certainly would raise about $20 million for the state. About $13 million of that comes to the Department of Transportation. The other seven, you know, by statute, goes to cities, communities, and counties to help fund some of their transportation needs. That's one issue that's been talked about, and that certainly originated from the Joint Revenue Committee, and we think that's a good idea and would be helpful.
I know Senator Barrasso has been working at the federal level to get more funding for states for their highway projects and maintaining their roads, and that a proposed bill passed out of his committee unanimously. And so I'm wondering what you think about that bill and what the department's reaction is to those efforts.
The bill is good. It's far-ranging. It certainly funds ground transportation systems in the United States for about the next 5 years. In fact, it's all transportation systems for the next 5 years. And it's more money than has been in those bills before. The effect on for us in the state of Wyoming would be about a 2% increase in the first year and then about a 1% increase in the following years.
Luke Reiner is the director of the Wyoming Department of Transportation. Thanks, Luke, for taking the time to speak with me today.
Thank you, ma'am. Have a great rest of the day.
When we come back, we'll talk about a new book that showed how Shoshones and Arapahoes created a high school in the Wind River Reservation and also chronicles the trials and tribulations surrounding that. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. Going to school might seem like an ordinary rite of passage for children, but in Indian country, school has long meant assimilation and discrimination. It's why, back in the 1950s, the two tribes on the Wind River Reservation began the arduous process of starting their own school. A new book called Sovereign Schools, How Shoshones and Arapahoes Created a High School on the Wind River Reservation, chronicles the trials and tribulations of making that dream a reality. Author Martha Louise Hibb has a vocal impairment that makes her difficult to understand on the radio, but her close friend and personal editor Carol Atkinson joined Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards. Atkinson starts by explaining how Hibb began writing the book as a psychiatrist for the reservation school district.
During her first year there, the superintendent of the school suggested that each person, on each staff member, do something about the school in terms of the history or the research, whatever it was. And so Martha was casting about for a topic, and some very clever elders on the reservation steered her toward a meeting at which one of the other elders said something about the school having a very interesting history. And so that's what Martha started on. And she probably could have written a 20 or 30 page report and met her responsibilities, but she got captured by the story, and it just went on and on and on.
You know, I wonder if you can start by talking a little bit about where sort of the history of education begins on the Wind River Reservation.
Well, I can't give you an exact date, but it started back in the boarding school days, and those boarding schools continued for a long time. Go ahead.
Well, it was 1884 when the first boarding school, an Episcopal school, started there. But before that, they were sending kids to Carlisle, Pennsylvania, for up to 8 years at a time.
The thing to mention there is the death rate. It was just incredible. And the disease rates were very, very high. In most of the boarding schools, the kids were not allowed to speak their own language or to maintain any of their own traditions. And it wasn't uncommon for them to come into the boarding school and immediately get their hair cut off and have to change clothes into something that was totally foreign to them. And the trauma rate, I mean, it was out of this world. It was awful.
Hip says that in the 1950s, indigenous students were integrated in county schools. There, they experienced discrimination. One student recalled being asked to enter through a back door. Native basketball players didn't get a ride on the bus, but had to hitchhike.
I think I see the whole situation as being part of the general civil rights movement, and it came to the reservation a little late. People decided that what was happening in the schools wasn't working for them. They needed to get equality in the schools. They needed to have some control in the school. And that was beginning to percolate in not just on Wind River, but some of the other reservations as well.
And it seems like that there was also right around this time, especially those early 70s, that the American Indian Movement began.
Yes.
And so there was, and education seems like that was something that was of interest to the American Indian Movement as well.
AIM was a little bit more radical, and the Arapaho and the Shoshone on the Wind River Reservation didn't think that that was the way for them to go. And they distanced themselves from the more radical aspects of AIM and stuck with a very civilized effort, working with politicians, working with anybody who would help them out to get their own school on the reservation without any kind of radicalization.
And what was the reaction to, you know, the state and to the school districts when the tribes started suggesting that this might be a better solution for their community?
The funding of schools is a very, very complicated issue. And the public schools got money for each Indian student, whether the student was attending that day or not. The situation in Fremont County, which is where the Wind River Reservation is, was very complex, with some of the towns having much better tax base than others. The Indian federal government payments to the local schools was very significant in the operation of those schools. And to lose those was a big threat. And they didn't want the reservation to have its own school because they would lose all of that money. But the Indians were very good at just maintaining. One of the more interesting parts of it is that the Arapaho and the Shoshone, for historical reasons, had been rivals. And when the Arapaho were brought onto the Shoshone reservation, it was this perfect setup for resentment and anger, and so there was tension between the tribes before any of the school issue came up. And one of the remarkable things on the Wind River Reservation is how the two tribes were able to work together and solve their disputes to then proceed and work toward a common goal.
What was the reaction of tribal leaders? How did they proceed? How did they decide which way to go next? Did they decide that it was time to get legal help, or what happened next?
Well, several things happened in a short period of time. They did have legal help. They had an attorney named Gross who had done some work on other reservations, came to help them. And they also went to Washington frequently, worked with congressmen. Senators from Wyoming were helpful. Senator Kennedy and his committee were very helpful. The BIA was not very helpful. The BIA was essentially an adversary in many of these cases. And it really seemed to me to be just a bureaucratic issue, not a rational issue. President Nixon was first encouraging for Indian sovereignty and then in practice totally against it.
Hip says back at home, tribal leaders took control of a local education committee and were able to succeed at convincing county officials to open the school. Meanwhile, at the national level, a coalition of tribes worked together to open their own schools. Wyoming Indian High School was considered the flagship of the movement because the effort was the most organized. The school now teaches children their native languages and is taught mostly by Native teachers. Well, thank you both so much for taking some time to talk about this really fascinating story about Wyoming Indian High School.
Thank you.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards talking with friend and personal editor Carol Atkinson and Sovereign Schools author Martha Louise Hipp.
As Wyoming talks a lot about sage-grouse, some young men at the recent Northern Arapaho powwow borrowed some of the bird's dance moves. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr caught up with four dancers competing in the prairie chicken category.
Hi, my name is DeAndre Augustine. I'm from Arapaho, Wyoming.
My name is Sam Hermini Horses.
Kershawn Spoonhunter.
My name is Isaiah Felter. I am Northern Arapaho and Lakota Sioux.
Yeah, I'm a prairie chicken dancer. I used to be a grass dancer, but chicken's cooler. Yeah.
It originally came from up north, Canada, Montana area.
It's based on an original dance that was formed in Kainai, Alberta, from the Blackfeet people.
Lakota's kind of adopted it. Then a lot of other tribes adopted it as well.
And they're emulating the prairie chicken in the mornings when the sun comes up. What they say is when they're out there dancing, they're pounding all of the bad spirits, all the bad thoughts and everything that are out there at night. They're pounding them into the ground so everybody can have a good day.
So you have to imitate the chicken moves in the morning, like right down here, like right where I stay, there's prairie chicken, sage chicken.
There's some down at my grandpa's old place near 17 Mile. They'll be there strutting in the hay field.
And it's also a mating dance at the prairie chicken zoo where they try to entice the hen out there.
It's meant to impress women. You'll see other chicken dancers wearing two feathers right at the end, and that represents him and her.
I made most of my outfit. Like, I made this otter top, I made this sash with deer toes, these hawk bells, eagle talons, and buffalo teeth.
These are cuffs. They're nice and beaded. Everybody wears cuffs, armbands,
a bustle. They usually wear lots of bells and like they wear these tights. They usually have plumes and stuff on their outfit.
When I get out there, I just try to think what a chicken would do out there dancing. And so that's just kind of a lot of it.
I don't know, there's usually a certain like a stomp, like a light stomp, but it's like, it looks heavy. Like it's a very light stomp, but it looks heavy. Like,
some people have a lot of head movement, like how a chicken would. And other people usually dance with their arms out to emulate the wings when they dance. And so a lot of different styles. Everybody has their own style.
Stationary old style. I normally would stay in within 5 to 10 feet radius. It's a little bit more smoother, slower. The new contemporary is more, they're kind of wild, just dancing all over.
You're impressing somebody. You're showing your moves off. They'll sometimes lift up their leg and shake it. Or they'll shake their bustle or their chest. Or they'll look at you and move their shoulders and stuff to you to get your attention.
I don't know, it's just a certain step to the chicken dance that just feels good to be out there because there's certain type of songs that just feel good.
I got some advice from Ronnie Harris III. He said, dance to mesmerize and never to show off. He said, spread your wings because the arena is yours.
To me, it's like my therapy. Once you're out there, you get that drum beat going. Whatever drum beat you get, you just kind of let go. And all the negative thoughts and everything going on in your life, you just let go for about 3 or 4 minutes and just enjoy the drum and just whatever, wherever it takes you, just go with it.
Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together. Saturday night right here, Northern Arapaho Powwow Indian Days. Man, that was awesome. Way to go, Little Brave.
Savannah Marr is a Report for America Corps member.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed part of the show or want to hear it again, you can find it on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces. You can also get the program via podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor.
Bringing you this high-quality, award-winning news program is not free. It takes dedicated reporters and the resources to get them across the state and the equipment to bring you interesting stories. Please support our Wyoming news coverage with your pledge today. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.